outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Chain.
So we reached an amazing milestone the same time This American Life did. This American Life, one of the biggest podcasts on NPR stuff. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know, I don't even know about this.
Their podcast last week was titled 666 colon.
Hey!
And then they went, I forget the theme
so
that shall not be named.
Ours.
And it was all about Satan.
Nice!
We reached 666.
They talked all about Jesus.
The same time This American Life did. I was like, and people were writing in about it. I didn't know that from anything other than people saying, do you guys realize you had exactly the same show that This American Life had this week? And it wasn't exactly the same show, but
wow,
same
theme
number. And
convergence.
Won the whole Satan thing.
And it was a full wolf blood moon too, Sunday. Right?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Did it do anything for you?
No, but it was cold outside. I did watch it, and it was like, ooh, cold, and then I went back in.
Was it like, did it fill the whole sky?
No, but I mean, it was kind of cool. Okay. But we had clouds that were just like buzzing overhead. I mean, I sat there like, wow, this is really windy, and the clouds are going fast. They didn't stop the eclipse from happening, but it was like, okay, wow.
Oh, This American Life, they interviewed Bob Larson, remember? Big demon chaser from back in the day. They interviewed him.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but they started with this interview, because I listened to it driving back from the Central Valley this yesterday. And because I was curious, where did they go with this? And they started out with a guy who'd started a Satan prayer line online. So people could call and
hail Satan online?
Make prayer requests.
Serious?
Of Satan. Yeah, get help from Satan for what they're doing. And he didn't do it as a Satanist. He didn't even believe in Satan or God, either one.
Kind of as a joke.
Not
mocking prayer?
It wasn't so much mocking. I think what he wanted to do is, what would people do if they had a prayer line to Satan? And what surprised him were the people that were calling really looking for help, like suicidal and like, you know, pregnant and not wanting a child and feeling like God wasn't a resource for them.
But maybe Satan was.
But maybe Satan would help them. And
my goodness.
It's interesting hearing him talk about it. He got really touched by the genuineness of a need for a line he kind of started for not that purpose.
Wow.
So I thought, wow, that is kind of
that's
interesting.
That's some hurting people, though.
A lot.
You would diss God. That's a very sad commentary.
Well, I don't know if you diss in God, but to me, if you're not going to believe in God, why would you believe in the other guy?
Agreed.
Yeah, how
that's
do you
sort
get
of
there?
Like a supernatural. I don't understand that.
If you don't like God and his ways, so you want to try some other spiritual power, that might make a little sense in some weird way. But to absolutely go, okay, the God thing isn't real, but maybe Satan is.
But you know, I think that's just coming out of people's desire to say, I need something. I need help.
Pain. Yeah.
You know, and it's like because we turn to 1,000 comforts. And I don't think we recognize how we empower things in our place of need. You know, it's like you always talk about, you know, really waiting on God to see and allowing him to give to you.
Yeah.
But I think most of us are a bit impatient and we grab for ourselves.
Yeah, we do. And it may always be, you know, if not God, then Satan. But if not God, then maybe
so
shopping. If not
something.
God, then food. If not God, then, drugs, alcohol. Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like we're real good at resting in the goodness of my Father to provide.
Yeah, even if as Scripture says, because I was reading Psalm 115 to my dad this weekend. My dad was in the hospital. I went up to be with him through part of it. And we were reading a psalm Sunday morning, Psalm 115, which is about, you know, making the idols. And they have hands that don't work and eyes that don't see and ears that don't hear.
And speak.
And you're going, okay, here's a group that knew the living God, at least had a great nature and heritage with him. But when trouble strikes, they're always turning somewhere else.
It's not just that
we don't know God
That's
exists, so we do
thing.
Something else. No, it's not. It's just ancient of, we got to have some power. And even if you, because they said they have hands and, or they have lips and speak not and eyes and see not, but that's your hope. That's where you've decided against the God who does have hands and does have eyes and not in the literal sense, but in a figurative sense, a God who is active, is alive, has often intervened on Israel's behalf. And you diss that because why would you diss that in hopes that some little statue you made that morning. You got up, got your little chisel, yeah, made a little face on the statue.
There's some serious lunacy in that.
They're really, but it's a common human trait.
See, but we're not making little figurines, but we do out of things. We sort of turn them into those things. I don't know that we recognize, oh, I'm bowing down and worshiping that. But I do go to other things to source out comfort, to try to find hope, to I'm tired, so I just want to do this. We don't go to the source.
Right. It's so easy to be distracted. That's what my dad and I talked about for about like half an hour. Like, what is it about us, you know, as humans, that we have this God
who's prone to wander.
The one who created it all, who loves us more than anyone on this planet ever has or ever will. He's there. He's always there, always ready to listen, always ready to intervene, and yet... And I think, part of what we talk about, sometimes, you know, you walk with them so long, you've prayed about so many things and been disappointed about so many things.
Oh, bingo.
That you finally bingo. Go, okay, that may not work. So if it just, if I can get a dopamine hit from a TV show.
A little dab will do you somewhere.
Social media, wherever you look for your little dopamine hits, that those dopamine hits, even if you, I got my new idol and I'm excited about bowing down to this thing. Whatever dopamine hit that is enough to distract us from the living God. Sad.
But I think disappointment's a big deal, because I think a lot of, I mean, if there's not many people that I think if I would ask the question to, they would say, oh yeah, best day ever. That's where I live my life all the time.
Right.
And I think when we have tangible hopes, desires, expectations, and we're yearning for those, and if they're spiritually inclined and we don't quite see God doing that thing that we hope for, you don't really want to keep going back for repeat disappointment. So you kind of shut down the expectation. And we don't stay open as great receivers when we do that.
Yeah, it may be that we want something that we feel like we can control. So if I do A and B, then God should do C and D or whatever. Uh-huh. If I go to my other little dopamine hit, wherever that comes from, it's always going to give me that little hit of something.
I think we worship the one who will answer us the quickest.
Even the least effective, but it's quick.
Yeah, I mean, no, but that's what I'm saying. I just think so oftentimes, because I've never met a real restful person in crisis. I would love to know many, but I don't. Most people in the midst of crisis is like, the anxiety, I got to do something. And it's like, no, maybe you don't. Because all the things you do in anxiety, my experience in life is they haven't ever panned out real well.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like we do have a knee-jerk anxiety that I've got to do something. So if I turn to that and it offers me a little something,
yeah,
it's pretty easy to get hooked thinking that even if it just pacified something. We turn to that.
Yeah.
And we don't play a long game. You know, it's like when it gets anxious, most of us don't sit down and go like, okay, time to get quiet, time to get still, time to listen, time to have a genuine talk with my Father, and let it take its course while I discern what's going on. That's not easy.
No, you know, I thought about this a little bit driving up to see my dad. He ended up in the emergency room, the hospital for a medical deal that got sorted out. He's fine now and home again. But driving up there, and at the potential driving up there, it could have been life-threatening, could have been.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking driving up there, this will be fun. Because my dad has somehow grown to the place in his journey where he doesn't have fear. He's not in crisis,
right?
Not panic. And I know that about him. I even told him, I called him and said, I'm on my way up early on Friday morning. He goes, hey, don't bother, man. Why don't you stay there? I know you got stuff to do. Thanks, Dad. I am coming up. But to see a guy, and people who came in the first day, particularly when I was there all day long, people are coming in who are finding out about it, and they want to come in and pray for him. And they're got their panic on. They're like, oh, God, don't let him die. And they're praying against death. And, oh, God, but if you want him now, we're willing to give him up. And I'm like,
what? They're loosing more anxiety than they are connecting. And
yeah, I learned more about prayer on Friday than I ever wanted to know. And it's not any other than well-meaning people. These are incredibly well-meaning, conscientious. I'm not dissing on them at all. They love my dad enough to come to the hospital when he's there. And yet, like you say, they're praying their fears. They're
kinda, we loose our anxiety.
And my dad's the only fearful person, in, not unfearful person in the room. Yeah. My dad's going.
So they're going doink.
He looks at me and he goes, this ain't going to kill me. I'm pretty sure of that. But even if it does, I don't care. Your mom's probably up there praying that it would, that I would get up.
Come on.
And I think of Missy and no impatience there. So no, she's not in a hurry. But it was fun because mostly when I've gone, somebody that's going to a family or whatever in a very desperate time, fear is just palpable crisis. Yeah. And again, reading the scripture with my dad, Psalm 115, ends by put your trust in the Lord, Israel. Put your trust in the Lord, Aaron. Put your trust. It's like, yeah. Boy, put all your eggs in that basket, because if you don't, you're going to have other baskets to go run to. I guess that's always, if my hope is only in him, and I will die here if nothing else happens, if you don't come through or whatever. And I don't mean that stay at home with your medical condition and trust in God only and not go to emergency room. I'm not even encouraging people that way. But in terms of the hope for how this situation resolves, if it's in it resolving the way I need it to resolve, and you're going to have fear and anxiety and look out for whatever desperate thing you can do. If your hope is in the Lord and God big enough to do whatever he wants to do and being in it with him till it's done,
I know, but I think for so many people, that might be doctrinally true. That might be something I can confess with an act of my will.
Oh.
But for few, it's not emotionally knowledge true. It's not like I know in my knower that I'm at peace. God is here in spite of the house burning down feel. Right.
And however this comes out, I'll be okay because he's going to lead me on.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you just choose to do that. I sort of feel like, we talked about that, being freed to the place to trust. I only have confidence because of what I've already gone through, and nobody likes going through stuff.
I don't.
I'm not asking you for more, but I now appreciate so much of what I have gone through because I end up going like, I'm here. I survived that too.
Yeah.
And there is an easier sense of just going like, gosh, I have actually learned more and gotten closer to God through the things that I have endured and suffered, some of my own creation,
yeah.
Others at the victimization of somebody else, where you're just going, well, I don't want to be that victim. And
sometimes we victimize other people.
Yes. Yeah. I can be perpetrated on and perpetrator.
Yeah,
okay?
Me too.
But I've really come to realize, wow, God, you can see me through this. And as much as I may not enjoy this, that doesn't stop you from using this in a profound way to touch and change and transform me. And I honestly think it's like, okay, now James is not just a crack smoker when he says, hey, blessed are you when you fall into all those kinds of diverse kinds of trials. Like, woohoo!
Yeah.
I used to think, like, that is so goofy. I'm not thankful for that. I don't know what he means by that. But when I look at the change over time that God has wrought, I'm going like, I don't think I would have necessarily allowed that to change unless I was sort of in that place of extremity.
Yeah, and you don't know how much the trust you have today for whatever bigger thing has come your way has been prepped for because, well, I survived that.
Yeah.
God was bigger than that. I had that thing go sideways, and God was still in my life drawing me onward, and I think at 93, like my dad, you're kind of like, what else can I face that didn't get me before now? I'm going to keep going. But I do think there's something really to be said for having our trust only somewhere. Because if it's like primarily in God, but secondarily,
we'll still turn to the other stuff, won't we?
Because God doesn't work as fast as we would like him to about anything, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right now, you
snap
didn't do
my
it.
Fingers.
Where's my genie?
I rung the bell. Where are you?
Genie in the bottle. Yeah, and then so immediately I got to have something to make me feel better, and we'll go do something to make us feel better.
But isn't that the residue of a whole bunch of, in our minds, unanswered prayer because it didn't get answered in the time frame and in the manner in which we kind of thought?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why thankfulness is so absolutely vital to renew my mind and thoughts on.
Yeah.
Because if I can stare at my lack and it does not help me at all. It's a fact. It might be true. It might be something to overcome. But the more I stare there, it's like whatever life I have just starts to leach out the bottom of my toes. And you're just going like, ah, it's not a great spot. I've just got a renewed sense of appreciation. It's like, as opposed to staring at that, I want to renew my mind according to the things that he has done that I am grateful for, because somehow that puts me back into, I can trust in his basket.
Yeah. I think the gratefulness is a great connection there, because it kind of just gets back to my celebration of God and who he is.
Uh-huh.
And my frustration at no answered prayer is always that I know better than God. And God didn't do what I think he should do when I think he should do it. And
I don't think we think that through, but it is there.
It is that. I mean, that's where it's coming from. And the gratefulness thing kind of puts it back on, oh my gosh, I'm his, he's mine. And
yeah.
Life wasn't meant to unfold, at least in this age. It wasn't meant to unfold challengelessly. And it doesn't. So,
in this life, you will have trouble.
Yeah.
That's not a memorized verse for many.
Keep trucking with it. So I'm Wayne Jacobson.
I'm Brad Cummings.
And those of you in the Atlanta area, headed there next week.
Ooh.
Headed this week, actually.
Pre-Super Bowl.
Yeah. I'm getting out of town the morning of.
Really?
Yeah. Super Bowl's in Atlanta. I'm there. I'm there
Go
the weekend
Rams.
Before for a retreat. And then I'm working on a book through the week. And then just a Saturday, Feb 2, the day before the Super Bowl, hanging out with some folks. If you want to join us, there's still room for you to do that. And then Sunday morning, because I didn't want to try and fly it up Atlanta on Monday morning. I just did not know.
No.
Plus, everybody's distracted with Super Bowl anyway. So I'm getting on a plane Sunday morning, flying home. And
Super Bowl.
I should be the only one at the airport. That's kind of what I'm banking on.
Maybe.
Probably the only
Probably
one.
Probably not.
You're leaving Atlanta today? Yeah, absolutely.
Probably not.
I'm out of here.
I can't wait. I'm excited about the Rams.
Oh, we're going to go to football. This is Sports Talk Radio with Wayne and Brett.
But I mean, I have not watched many football game at all this whole season. But ever since the shooting and the fires, and most of those dudes live out here.
Yeah.
Somehow I got my heart connected to and started to get to know some of their hearts. And they really poured themselves out for this community. And
yeah,
I
they have.
Went, oh, my God.
Absolutely. But
And
the NFL must have thought that way, too, because they stole the game.
Yes, I know.
They stole the game from the poor
Saints. I know. I feel bad about that. But
worst call in football history.
Sure.
Non-call. Yeah.
But
it worked out the way I want.
No.
Injustice is lovely when I benefit from it.
I'm making none of those points. I just am excited because I felt before we even got there. It's like there just was a little something where I went, oh, Lord, it's the Rams season. It is. It just is. I just felt that.
It would just be nice.
I instantly became a fan.
It just would have been nice if they would have earned it.
I'm
pulling for them, too. I really am. In all honesty,
they didn't not earn it.
And they shouldn't be the LA
Rams. But that was not a fair call.
And in all honesty, they're not the LA Rams. They're the Thousand Oak Rams.
I know.
Yeah, they're right here.
I know.
Right here in hometown. But, yeah, but still they don't deserve to be there. They just don't.
That's not true.
No.
That call deserves to go back to that moment, but they were in it right there.
But that completion ends the game.
No.
It does. Because now they're going to get a touchdown. They're going to eat more clock.
No,
Rams don't have time
but
to
that didn't happen. You don't know that.
I do know
You
that.
Don't know You don't. You presume that.
You know, I'm not hearing anyone else. I'm not hearing anyone else in the whole football world make the point you're trying to make.
I know, but that's. I could have made that point. So.
You can find Brad at his website, DelusionsRUs.
There you go. I got my eggs in that basket.
So anyway, if you want to go to Atlanta for other than the Super Bowl, or if you're already hanging out in the area and tired of all the traffic and hassle, then come
Very
see
nice.
Us. We're going to hang out with some people. I found this article a couple weeks ago. I sent it to you, Brad, because I thought, man, this is a heroin addiction explained, how opioids hijack the brain.
Oh, no, I think it's fascinating.
It is a fascinating article. It was in the New York Times. We'll link it so you can find it if you want to look at it as well. Opioid epidemic is a conversation all its own. I mean, it really is. What I got out of this article, and I'm sure we'll probably do both, but what I got out of this article is how much sin works in us exactly like an opioid does. How it may not hijack our brain, all it does, but it hijacks our heart and our life the same way. And one of the things I want to say is I've mostly been people who are addicted to drugs obviously made some bad choices that landed them there. You know, so it's kind of a.
Yeah, but we're not very merciful to recognize why they're stuck.
It's a behavioral disease is how you've seen it. But this article makes clear it's not that. It chemically alters your brain to need it. The people who designed the drug knew it.
Yes.
They lied to get it approved. And now there are more people dying of opioid addiction today than anything else in America.
I know. Oh, 70 to 80,000 a year.
Oh, gosh.
And you're going like, that's atrocious.
Yep.
You know, we got people protesting, you know, war things. We just go like, none of the wars that are being fought right now come anywhere close to this.
Not auto accidents, not airplane accidents for sure. Yeah, nothing.
And you're going like, oh, my lands. And the people that are overdosing, it's not as if they don't know they're stuck. And chances are it's not as if they don't want out.
Yeah.
And yet they are genuinely stuck to the point that they're dying.
Yeah.
And are you able to walk us through a little bit of
this? Yeah,
those are so amazing.
We can walk through some of it and see what we got here. But I just want to – one of the definitions I heard about sin a long time ago, Ron Mell, a Foursquare pastor out of Beaverton, Oregon, I think, or somewhere up there near Portland. He used to say this, and I remember I heard this almost 40-some-odd years ago. Sin will always take you further than you want to go, make you stay longer than you want to stay, and cost you more than you'd ever want to pay.
Yeah, but you don't know any of that when you say
no,
yes.
No, you don't. And that's the same way with this.
That's the sucky part.
So they have seven stages they outlined in this article in the New York Times. One was stage one is the gateway. You naturally produce endorphins,
yep.
The body's own version of opioids, which act in the reward circuits of the brain to make you feel good after you work out, hug a friend, or eat your favorite foods. A drug like heroin creates a tidal wave in the reward circuits of the brain. To an outsider, it looks as though you've passed out. But on the inside, you feel like the master of your universe, like you've just been hugged by Jesus. That was the article.
That one intrigued me. I just went, oh, my lands. They are describing. I get why, you know, Paul was saying, you know, be constantly being filled.
Yeah.
With the Spirit. Don't be drunk with wine. I'm going, you know what? What he's describing there is not dissimilar from a marvelous encounter with God.
Except that you still remain in control of yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm not wired for slavery.
Yeah. And so it goes on to say, we lost the thing here. In the beginning, no serious ill effects are apparent, but the brain rewires itself little by little with each use.
And it comes screaming back for the need.
But that's comes later. He said, you get the endorphin, you get the big endorphin. Now, I've never had this. Heart surgery, toe surgery, I've had opioids prescribed to me. I take it for pain. I get no buzz, nothing. I don't feel good afterward. I feel nothing. I don't know I don't know how it works in some people's brain. It doesn't work that way in mine. Maybe I need to take more.
Recently, because of the whole Chasing the Dragon movie.
Yeah,
I've talked to the people that for 50 years
have
been stuck in heroin.
Yeah.
And what I thought this article did a fantastic job of accurately describing why they get stuck and that they get rewired. And it's your body starts to cry out for what it's missing. And you start to feel worse than you ever have. And you start going for more, not because you're going to get the same high, but because you can no longer handle the lows.
Yeah, this is what it tells. Stage two is tolerance. You're chasing the siren of the first high by taking more. But even 1,000 more doses will never bring back the experience of the first time.
I know.
The brain balances its own endorphins like a thermostat. The brain's response to these chemical changes makes life difficult without the drug.
Trying to protect you.
Yeah, stress and irritability creep in, so you make opioids, so you take more to cope. And soon nothing else in life provides satisfaction.
Yeah, and you really do get rewired and so imbalanced that your body goes into fits that are absolutely painful. It's like what they described in terms of taking heroin so as to just be able to get through the day. You just go like, oh my gosh. It's like they do it to stay functional. They're not functional, but in order to not feel so absolutely distraught, as the withdrawal from it comes on. And I just sat there going like, okay, if you've never been one of those people, you can just look at them like, you know, come on, you just got to use your chooser.
Yeah.
And just Yeah. And you're just going like, no way. There's something so much deeper that has to be shifted for them to get freedom.
That's why I'm hoping we all could relate out of the whole sin thing. It's the end of stage two here, it says the pleasure and reward cycles flip. You get less pleasure from the drug, but want it all the more.
Yeah.
Isn't that how sin works in us? I mean, if you've never done drugs, you at least know how sin gets in there.
I'm pretty sure all of us can identify with something like that.
Stage three is withdrawal. I mean, there's seven stages. My goodness, seven is withdrawal. Three is withdrawal. Final trap of addiction is laid when you muster the courage to stop. You may not even realize you are physically dependent until you experience withdrawal for the first time. Crippling pain, vomiting, insomnia, spasms, hot cold flashes, goosebumps, congestion and tears, all this on top of debilitating anxiety and depression. You might feel like you have the worst flu of your life or like a demon is crawling out of your skin.
That's pretty accurate.
Interesting thing. You start with a hug from Jesus, and now you're down to a demon crawling out of your skin. Wow. And that's only three steps. One, two, and three. Next one is addiction. The brain screams for more. You no longer take the drug to get high, but to escape feeling low. Scoring the next fix feels like a race against the clock of withdrawal. It makes no sense, but this compulsion takes over all logic, judgment, and self-interest.
And it destroys everything.
You may do things you never thought you could, sell your body, abandon your child, steal from your mother. You might lose your job, lose your home, lose your loved ones. This sad stage, families are torn apart.
Yep.
Gosh. And then we get to treatment, stage five. You hit rock bottom, perhaps after running with the law. You fear withdrawal. You dread confronting why you started and who you have become. Willpower alone may not be enough, and quitting cold turkey will increase the risk of overdose. You may not have access to treatment. You may not be able to afford it, or you've heard that quitting is impossible and that taking medication to help is simply swapping one drug for another. They're actually pretty set on there. They've got drugs now they can use to take people off of this, but most people resist it because it just seems like the same thing, but it's not. And those medications are available, but not enough people have access to them or use them.
Well, just trying to go cold turkey can be really destructive. And at least the folks that were, you know, giving us testimonies of just how they take them through, that's why they throw themselves completely dependent on the Holy Spirit. And they're just saying it makes the sort of detox less painful. And it's like they're finding a way to draw life from God as he supernaturally is rewiring and enabling them to get free.
You got to love that whole renewing of the mind work that the Spirit does and why that's critical.
Yeah, it's profound when you understand what actually happens to.
Because it's not just your desires get out of whack. You're talking really brain chemistry stuff. Stuff gets out of whack inside the brain. And now everything's flipped on its head. You're seeking after the wrong thing uncontrollably. And I know a lot of traditional Christianity that I grew up in doesn't like that kind of talk about sin being addiction because it all goes back to your chooser and your will and you got to do better. Yeah. And if our hope is in our human effort, our human will to resist this or sin in our lives,
we're not going to do so good.
You're going to lose.
Because, I mean, even I don't know if I've listened to some folks talk about the whole dynamics of pornography and what it does to our brain and the chemicals that get released. And it's not dissimilar from what's being described here.
You're absolutely like, true.
It gives you a hit, gives you little dopamine. You start getting rewired. It's in that lust realm that's going like, I'm not satisfied with what I have. I need more in order to just get back to where it was.
Or get back to something that's minimally satisfying.
Yeah. And it's like, it ruins things in us. And there is, I just feel like, my gosh, there is so much restorative, reparative work that God does need to do that I don't think we've paid enough ample attention to.
Yeah. And even say pornography is one example of this. You actually lose your ability for normal sex.
Yes.
Seeking this false version of it that's endorphin high, but it ruins
your capacity to actually have those emotional connections with another person.
Yeah, because you're not having them with anything.
And you just end up going like, oh my gosh. Because the drugs do the same thing.
Yeah. That's what I loved about this article. I just saw so much of not only how it influenced. I mean, yeah, it's true of the opioid thing, and it's gives me a different kind of compassion for those that are caught in the opioid thing. It really does. But it also takes me a different place with whether it's pornography or whether it's any other kind of sinful thing, that things really do get addicting. And I know we used – my tradition used to make fun of that. You know what I mean?
I know. If you come from a stronger Bible or a little more Baptist kind of thing, it's like you – it's the strong chooser.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. You're not making the right choices.
Yeah, and if you're a good chooser and you're kind of been in that environment, your chooser is at a level you can do that. You don't realize how someone else's brain has been rewired in a way that without love and connection with God and, like you said, the supernatural power of the Holy Spirit to turn this dude around, it's not going to happen just because I give them the rules to act better, and they're certainly going to follow.
Yeah, and the admonition to be a chooser. It's like, you know what? Some people, because I did not validate this when I would look at it. Most of the time I'd go like, well, come on. You just need to renew your mind and think right. And just go like.
If you love Jesus enough.
I know.
If you love me, you'll keep my commandments.
And I just go like, what a failure of compassion to actually understand the damage that sin and repetitive sin actually does.
Yeah, and what love needs to be there to help walk them out.
Yes.
The sixth stage, just so we get to the end of these, you know what the other, which I think is great. I think we ought to be aware of this with sin too and any struggle in our life. Relapse is a normal part of recovery. It also brings dangers, but after abstaining from the drug, your tolerance decreases even if the cravings remain intense. The same amount of the drug you took before can result in overdose, especially if it's laced with fentanyl or mixed with benzodiazepines and alcohol. In the overdose, your body is unable to handle the drug that you were already taking. That's why.
I think that's why we have so many people dying.
Yeah, it's not like I'm trying to overdose.
They are trying to get free. And in the exchange, all of a sudden, it's like this thing overpowers them.
And how many Christians have I met or people that are looking to follow Jesus and they're on the track and they got focused on him and they're doing really well? And then they have a relapse, have a moment of despair in their life, and they kind of go back to some comforting thing. And then it's so easy to turn on them. And for them, they turn on themselves.
The sickness of shame is so awful, because in that moment, as opposed to recognizing it, you know what? God sees the yes in my heart. I may not have the maturity. I may not have the developed growth and ability to actually pull together a whole string of obedience.
Right.
But God does see the yes in my heart, and he does speak to that. And he's not like, oh, you fell again.
You stupid fool.
Yeah. You know, I know I've been that guy. You fell again. I'm offended that they fell again. And it's like, you just go like, see, you're not choosing right. And you just go like, because we don't build that in to recognize that it's like, you know what? Our feet are prone to wander without excusing anything in the realm of sin. I just don't think we recognize how destructive and the ruts that it can create and how challenging it is to get those smoothed out so I don't keep falling back in.
I'm reminded of a story that Bob Stamps told us about this womanizing guy that came to Christ at this church. And he, as he's coming to Christ, he said, I just don't think I'm going to be able to give up women. I'm not going to be able to give up sex. He's a single guy. He's just, out playing the field. And the pastor guy, it wasn't Bob, it was somebody else. The pastor guy said, just do one thing for me, would you? When you fail sexually and you come on Sunday morning, why don't you just come tell me? He said, what? Yeah, just come tell me. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, just come tell me. So every Sunday for like months, he always comes in and says, I did it, man. I failed again this week. I was going not to, but I did. And he said, you're forgiven. The Lord loves you. Go your way. He didn't shame him. Didn't tell him to stop. Didn't. And
just transacted.
Week after week after week. And then he noticed the guy wasn't coming anymore. Wasn't coming up to him. He's thinking, oh no, what's really going on? Next week doesn't come up to him again. Third week he doesn't. So he finally chases him down after service and he says, where you been, man? What's going on? He said, oh, what do I mean? I haven't needed to see you. I haven't been following. He says, what? And here's what he said. This is what Bob loves this quote. I do too. He said, I just couldn't keep on sinning in the arms of grace.
Oh, that's a keeper.
Isn't that a great statement?
That's a keeper.
But all that relapsing and all that loving through relapse and all that not shaming people at the point of failure and the point of struggle, how long did that go on? How many of us would have had the patience to be able to say, for the other guy to discover at some point, I just couldn't keep sinning in the arms of mercy?
Because I think we think it is an act of our will that is what brings obedience, as opposed to the transformation of my soul. I'm going like, the will is just one part of me. I got to renew the mind. I need healing in the realm of my emotions. And I need strengthening in my capacity to say yes. All of those, sin has compromised me. Shame is this nasty block from me getting to the source.
Yeah.
And until that gets removed, we don't make for really good obeyers.
That's why Titus, it said, it's the grace of God that teaches you to say no. And I know in our Baptist interpretation of that, where I grew up, it gives grace about an hour and a half to do that. The teaches. Well, once you know the grace of God, you just stop doing stuff. But what if that teaches is, it may be a 3-year process right there of you falling into the arms of mercy and responding to God and grace, and just let it have, till the brain is rewired not to need the thing that sin's fulfilling in your life.
See, as a good little pastoral sheepdog,
that's no good.
I felt it was my job to bark at the sheep if they ever got close to the fence line. You know?
Right.
I got to scare them back.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of going like, yeah, because there was another friend that would just say, hey, if that's in you, you might as well go and do a ton of it. Just go. And I'd be like, oh, that's terrible advice. And I honestly so wrestled with it. Like, I don't think that's good. I think that's foul, because that they're going to get destroyed doing that. And I think what he knew, that is an aspect that I could have learned from, was until we actually recognize the lie that sin is, we're under its power. We don't have our trust all placed in Jesus's basket. I really am going to run to that real quick, because I think that's going to give me what I want. Hmm. And until I recognize the utter failure of that, it's pretty hard to cut off that little route.
Yeah. And the only scripture I've heard to justify this is, well, after all, Jesus told the woman caught in adultery, go your way and sin no more. Like, okay, now I've forgiven you. It's all over. You stop. Instead of, as we've talked about before on here, what if the go and sin no more was the empowering? It wasn't a command.
I think those words from him gave her a capacity that on her own she didn't have.
Yeah, and even if she did relapse, even if she did, that it's the grace of God that teaches you to say no. So if you don't say no yet, you still need grace to teach you. You don't need grace withheld until you say no.
And the very person to run to is the one that knows and can give you. I mean, it's like the whole verse, Hebrews 4:16, you know, come boldly before the throne of all grace, that you might receive mercy in your time of need and grace to help. It's like, that's recognizing you screwed up.
Yeah.
So run to him and get both. Get the mercy you need. Yes, you're guilty. Own it quick.
Yeah,
I just wish we were great owners of our sin.
Make it easy, wouldn't it? That's that confess your sins. That's where forgiveness begins inside of us.
Well, why? I mean, people don't like me always asking why. But why is that so hard? Why do we not find it quick to own our sin when it's exposed?
Shame.
So how do you get rid of that?
Cross.
Okay, good. There you go.
I have one word.
Thanks, ladies and gentlemen.
Shame, cross.
Good answers.
And if that's not real, man, ask him to make it real. See, just keep asking. That's where the reality is. It's easy to say it, absolutely, than to live it. But man, that's where
that
it
has to penetrate.
Yeah, it
because
does.
Because until the power, because I mean, I loved the So You Don't Want to Go to Church book, and the way
I do too.
Your buddy summarized it in the fact that, you know, religion is in the shame management business. Mm. And it's like Jesus is in the shame removal business. We got to stop managing.
No, for sure.
Our sin, because I think that's what leaves us prone to addiction.
Yep. Stage 7, we're at the end of this anyway. Stage 7 recovery. Colors get brighter. Smells are more intense. Emotions just are more powerful because opiates numbed them. Talking about recovery. Recovery is complicated. It takes time, but it's not impossible. Experts say treatment could require 6 months to 20 years. Learning to say no.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
One expert says the average person could relapse 4 or 5 times over 8 years to achieve a single year of sobriety.
And
this is without God, of course. This is just looking at it from a humanistic standpoint. But you add God to this mix, and it still doesn't mean it's overnight. It still doesn't mean, oh, I came to God, now I'm not ever sinning ever again. Come on, let's be real about that stuff.
Yeah, there was a link to something. I sent it to you. There was this other, I forget his name, but my son sent it to me, and it was sort of looking, is a whole different fresh look at how we deal with addicts. And one of the things I thought was just brilliant that was said in this is that so much the problem is a loss of meaningful connection and the need for real relationship. I mean, that's how love touches us. That's how love changes us. If I want to be able to walk in the power of his spirit, that's a relational reality. I've got to find that friendship with Jesus, or guess what? That little power that I want is not there. But in relationship, a pathway for it is.
Yeah, they were talking about, I listened to that video, and we'll link it at the bottom of this. So if you want to go see the video Brad's talking about, you can go look at it. One of the things that really won me to that, because coming from the Vietnam War generation, is how many guys were addicted to drugs in Vietnam. And when they came back, they were expecting addiction just to destroy the planet. But people who came back from Vietnam who had meaningful connections in their lives left the drug in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And they didn't go through withdrawal, rehab, whatever. They came back to connection. And connection, which is the whole point of this video, connection with God, with other human beings, love is the answer to everything. I had a really intense lunch today. And one of the things we talked about is even if somebody's going down the wrong road, their only hope is your love for them, being a conduit to the love of the Father for them. It's love that makes a connection, that makes the transformation, that begins to rewire the brain with grace and get you back to where God always wanted you to be.
Religion has lied to us thinking, if I give them heap loads more shame, that will somehow get them to turn around.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, it completely bars the door.
It does, which is why the cross.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.